Okay. How do the rock stars do it? You know, dancing all over? How does Mick Jagger do it? All right. So, obviously, I want to try and just talk a little bit about what we're doing or why I think this works in some way. All right. So in some way, I think it's, when I think about it outside of experience, it's really quite amazing, almost unbelievable, that this simple process of present moment awareness, just as we're saying, just noticing, just being aware of what's happening, being aware of what's happening, let life do itself and keep being aware. How can that actually be a condition for really helping to free the heart and mind from suffering and confusion? Because indeed it is. I mean, certainly it isn't that this is just some isolated methodology. We're not cultivating, I mean, I'm not offering, and my understanding, we're not cultivating present moment mindfulness just for its own sake. That actually the power of it can really, it really can manifest in different moments and in growing moments of a real opening us into the peace and ease of heart and mind, as Ajahn Amaro likes to say, the natural peace and ease of heart and mind that is the natural peace and ease of heart and mind. You know, he gives the example, just hang out in that and then see what disturbs it. So that's another meditation instruction. But so remember when I gave that definition of Vipassana meditation as experiencing the mind and body directly from moment to moment with the right understanding. So I just want to remind you of that again. So this is really amazing. How does that, this is just one way of talking about it, how does that actually begin and continue to free us from suffering? And what is the suffering it's freeing us from? It's the experiencing what's actually happening with the right understanding, not through our lens of our assumptions, our conclusions of what we think is happening, because then actually we're not experiencing what's really happening. And in fact, in some ways, the Buddha said, until we really cultivate some steadiness of this moment-to-moment awareness free from our overlays, we don't actually know what's happening. And in a way, that's the source of so much of our suffering and confusion. The Buddha, you know, this comes from the Buddha, and when he shared, everything he shared, as far as I can tell from reading and all, he said again and again, you know, I'm just teaching you about suffering and the ending of suffering. That everything he shared, and of course there's volumes and volumes of methodology and of information and ways of looking at the world, but he wasn't sharing any of it so that we could have more philosophical knowledge. You know, that he's really offering us, this is all the different ways I can talk about what brings us into recognizing the potential for peace and ease that is the potential of every human being. You see, that's why I'm offering it, because I can understand it, you can understand it. But, as he said, it's not, even that's not a, like for a philosophical thing for us to take on, but it's to really learn and see for ourselves. There's a very a famous one-word saying of the Buddha, ehi pasiko, which means you too come and see. Come and explore for yourself. And that's what all the meditation practice, all these retreats are. They're invitations to give some, you know, some guidance, but to really bring this quality of kind, interested awareness into our present moment experience to start to see what's really going on. Because what's really fascinating, we talk about right understanding, or one of the translations into English of Panya, wisdom, right understanding, is right view. And it's really, I like that translation in terms of the way I'm talking about it this afternoon, because right view is, you could think it's actually literal. That what brings us into confusion and suffering is recognizing our experience wrongly. That when the Buddha woke up and really said, he felt that his heart and mind was free from suffering, and he wanted to offer that to people. It took me years to recognize he didn't wake up in a different world. That his freedom from suffering didn't mean that the difficulties of the world went away. You know, there's suttas even where he has a backache, where he has a headache, so the body's still doing its number. People are still doing their number. You know, and even then there was, you know, racism and wars between clans people and fights over water and water rights and relatives in the Sangha and the other monks trying to kill the Buddha out of a power play and, you know, all the stuff that people do out of confusion and pain kept going on. So what was different, and as best we can understand, as best I can understand, that the freedom he talks about arises not because the circumstances of the world change and become the way we think they ought to be, but because how he understood and thus responded to circumstances really changes. And that's the place that the steady moment-to-moment awareness can really bring a vast difference into our life. When we recognize more accurately the way we respond to the situation is aligned with the situation. It means we still respond, even though we're saying this prayer just with awareness, notice whatever's happening, don't fight it, don't be in contention. And sometimes people think you're just, what are you teaching us to do? Just sit around and watch everything and never act, never function. But that's not it, because we're functioning all the time, right? We're making choices all the time. You get up, do you turn right or do you turn left? What do you have for lunch? When do you go to the toilet? And why do you go to the toilet? Noticing why. You know, the decisions are being made all the time. So bringing in awareness to see when we're not just doing it from blind habit, the reason we choose to do it can be more in alignment with how things are. So that's what we start to see. The same world recognized differently. We don't respond in ways that increase our suffering. So that's what we're talking about, accurate recognition, and I'll give some examples. Well, Mingyur Rinpoche, great Tibetan teacher, says, if we want to be happy, we must figure out, not by thinking about, but by watching, we must figure out what causes and conditions lead to well-being. Similarly, if we do not have a clear understanding of the conditions that create suffering, how can we possibly expect to free ourselves from it? And that's what it is said, that the Buddha first said or thought after he was away. He looked around, and what moved him to, this is what it said, you know, in the text, what moved him to compassion to spend the remaining 45 years of his life wandering around teaching people was seeing, because it said that he had like omniscient vision, you know, could read people's minds, was seeing that really deeply each of us, each human being does want to be happy. And that that's, you know, possible. But that through not understanding what real happiness is possible, what happiness is, we keep on doing things to try and be happy, to think that will make us happy, that keep us confused and suffering. And so this is as Mingyur Rinpoche says, if we don't understand what are the conditions that lead to suffering, how can we expect to free ourselves from it? You know, if we want to be happy, what are the conditions? And so this is what, in this form of practice, this steady awareness, allowing life to reveal itself in our body, in our mind, seeing what the mind does and why, and then keeping being present and noticing the effects. it starts to show itself. It's not like we have to go home and make a list and figure it out. All of a sudden you go, oh, that's what's going on. Oh, that's why I'm suffering right now. So this example I've been using the last couple of years, when we recognize accurately, our confused responses drop away, not because we think they should, but because they don't make any sense. We're responding to something that isn't there, really. And so this example I give in the last couple of years is from watching my young nephew kind of growing up. He's 5 now, but when he was two, three years old. And this is just very simple, but watching how kids learn. So, you know, it's an old-fashioned game. I don't know. He still had one. Maybe kids don't do it anymore because it's not on their iPad, which they have at age 6 months. But these, like, a big wooden thing with holes in it, different shaped blocks, square, triangle, whatever, circle. And then you have a block, and you put it in the right shape. But when the kid's first starting to learn, he doesn't have a sense of shape and matching the block to the shape. So the adult shows, and it goes in easy, and it looks easy. And then he takes the block and tries to put the circle in the square, and it doesn't work. And he tries to takes another one, and it doesn't work. And the kid gets really frustrated. Because it looks to him he's doing the same thing his father was just doing. But it worked for the father, and it didn't work for him. And not knowing why, all the reactions that come up in a kid, but we're not so different, of frustration, and if he were thinking in an adult way, he'd be thinking, there's a secret he's holding out on me, he's not telling me how this really works, why doesn't he show me, he's being mean, or I must just be hopelessly stupid, you turn the aggression out or you turn it in, I can't do it, I'm useless, and could just end up with throwing the blocks or the whole thing against the wall, right, and walking, I'm never doing that again, that's a stupid game, right? And that's the suffering, is that they didn't show me how to do it right, they're holding out on me, this game is stupid. But then at some point, sooner or later, maybe by accident, the triangle goes in the triangle. He goes, oh, that worked. And maybe doesn't get it right away, but soon, pretty soon, it's just so obvious that the shape matches the shape and there's no trick about it anymore. He can do it every time. It's easy. And all that frustration and all those thoughts, they're gone, right? Because they have no relevance once the kid recognizes how it works. That's a simple example. But that's how it works. When there's accurate recognition of what's the problem in the situation, then the response is appropriate. And all the other stuff that we could spin in, for weeks, for months, for years, goes away, not because we make it go away from some act of will, but it stops being created in the moment because it doesn't make sense. And this is the suffering the Buddha is talking about, looking and seeing how suffering is created in our mind and heart in a moment, and how it dissipates in our mind and heart in a moment. How happiness, how wisdom arises in our mind and heart in a moment. It's all happening here. It's not really here, but wherever, it's not really locatable. But as Ajahn Chah says, it's like Central Station. Everything starts from Central Station and goes out from there. You don't have to follow everything. Just hang out at Central Station and it all comes here and ends here. That's kind of what we're doing. But when we really see how it is, the sense of aversion or wanting it to be different doesn't come up. It's like the laws of gravity. Probably, I guess, most of you probably don't spend too much time in resistance to the laws of gravity. Right? That's just how it is. And when you're little, you think you can jump off the roof and fly because you don't really understand, and hopefully someone stops you from doing that. But now we know, and we'd say if someone came in and was all in angst and upset because, the laws of gravity, they threw it up and it came down again, and you dropped something and it fell, we'd say, come on, get real, wake up. This is how the world is. That's what the Buddha's saying. Wake up. This is how the world is. So that's, in one way, that's really a remarkable opportunity, because it's saying we don't have to. And in fact, waking up isn't about moving into some other realm that we create. It's not about somehow you've got to have a better personality. It's more that with the willingness, and this is where the sense of, you know, commitment moment to moment, the sense of perseverance, that's really the balance of effort, energy we put in this, just the perseverance, the willingness to remember that with steady awareness, reality reveals itself because it's already like that. It's already like this. For instance, taking the fact of impermanence, which I'm not going to go into so much in this, but that's one of the obvious teachings, right? That everything's arising and disappearing. It's not like if you get enlightened, then everything becomes impermanent, right? I mean, that's how it is. It's already how it is. So we somehow the mind, the habit of mind that isn't a steady awareness just doesn't recognize it. If you shake anybody and say, don't things change? You go, oh yeah, things change. When you say, well, didn't you have that mental state this morning and it's gone now? Oh yeah, right, I thought it was going to last forever. And you feel when some difficult emotion comes up, that the message in it is, and the rest of my life, through the lens of this emotion, even though we've seen it come and go 10 million times by now, it'll still come, oh no, here this is again, and I'm going to have to drag through even just the rest of the day. Like this, it's unbearable, you know, and the next moment something else is going and we forgot. So it's really recognizing accurately the suffering that's being created in the heart mind falls away. A little example that Tejaniya gave. He said a foreign yogi, so I mean they weren't used to the temperatures of Burma, arrived to practice at our center in Myanmar. It was just before the rainy season. That's like really hot, just before the rain, like hot. I don't know, it'd be in Fahrenheit, in the 40s at least, and super humid, probably 98% humidity. You just drip. The heat was very intense, with a temperature at about 105 degrees, whatever that is in Celsius, up there. So on the day this yogi arrived, he went in the Dhamma hall in the middle of the afternoon to sit. It's a nice Dhamma hall. But the men's Dhamma hall is on the second floor, so it's even hotter up there. They don't have AC there. At the moment he sat down to meditate, the thought went through his mind, I can't do this. I'm going to melt into the floor. I'm going to die. You know, it said, you know, the mind says that with total belief. This is the way it is. It's impossible. I can't do this. I'll die, you know. Have you ever had that feeling about something? It's just no, there's just no way. And without the structure sometimes of a meditation retreat, there is no way. That's where we're left because we're up and out of there, you know. There's no way. That's absolutely the truth. But suddenly, wait, I see I'm missing something. But suddenly, before he even stopped thinking this, the thought was just coming in, the awareness realized that his mind was cool. Only his body was hot. And so he recognized, you know, separate the mind is cool, the body was hot, but he knew then, like wisdom arose, if he kept hydrated, there would be no problem. It'd be hot, but he wouldn't die. So he recognized the heat was an object of experience, heat, just nature, not personal. Not personal meaning not me, not mine, not who I am. And this is the right view. Heat is like this. Understanding had arisen into the causes and conditions. This is the conditions. It's hot. The body feels like this. It's heat. The mind is cool. You keep hydrated. It's okay. That's wisdom, just recognizing the conditions are as they are. So that's right view. It doesn't change the heat. You get that? It doesn't make it cool and lovely. It's still hot. The body's still going to be there dripping wet. Dripping, believe me. But the mind is cool and we're not suffering. Freedom from suffering doesn't mean freedom from unpleasant experience. That's what really recognizing the Buddha's awakening in this world can show us. There's still unpleasant experience, but we're not, the mind isn't adding to it or taking unpleasant experience as the sign necessarily that something's wrong. when we can rest with awareness, okay, it's pleasant or unpleasant, it's like this, and the clarity can come in like this yogi, oh, okay, this heat, do this, I'm not going to die, can be with it, and the mind is cool, and there's awareness. That may not be the idea of freedom from suffering that people come into meditation practice with. Maybe we don't enunciate it to ourselves so much, but often it's the sense, you know, there shouldn't be unpleasant. It should be better than this. You're telling me that all I'm going to do is be able to be dripping wet and not be upset about it? You're telling me I'm going to have this pain in my knee and it's going to be, the mind's going to be quite cool about that? That's what you're offering? I'm afraid so. The power of this is huge. It's the power that changes our lives. And as long as we are lost in thinking, freedom means we get the heck out of this every situation. We get out of this world. We get out of politics. We get out of, people are going to start all behaving correctly. When it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. We're still going to have our feeling. People are going to do their thing, but we don't have to add. Not that we do it on purpose. Through confusion, through not recognizing accurately to our own suffering. So why don't we recognize accurately? If it's that, by really being present with things as they are, the mind of wouldn't get so confused, we wouldn't suffer. Why? What gets in the way? And I can't answer back to the beginning why it's set up like this. I do not know. It doesn't seem like a good setup. But I can, even the Buddha said things to think about that will drive you mad. One is the beginning of things. He said, it's just not helpful. He said, I'm teaching you what will help you wake up, not everything I know. So you want to know the beginning of things? So do I. Does it help to want to know it? No. So being present with what is. He said, it's like, he knows all the leaves in the forest, but what he's offering is just this handful of leaves, because that's what can free our hearts and minds. So if you can't be content with that, notice wanting, wanting, wanting. So what's in the way? And this is what the Buddha offered. And in my experience, I really recognize more and more, if you can get interested in seeing how these things work rather than taking it personal, it really helps. So what he's saying is what obscures things as they are, and why I was talking earlier, these qualities that arise in the mind of wanting, greed, leaning into, and that's always leaning into an experience that's pleasant, that we like, right? Unless you like pain, then you'd lean into that. You know, there's some people who do. But leaning into pleasant. Or the other habit of aversion, fear, resistance, that pulling away from the unpleasant. And so, and the sense of taking it personally, it's all about me. These three qualities in the mind, but that's what I was talking about Kalesa before, they're not the only qualities. There's many beautiful, like the Dalai Lama said, I was looking for that quotation and couldn't find it. He really feels like these qualities of wholesomeness, of compassion, of wisdom, appreciation, gratitude. These are, so are really basic natural human values. When these other three, one or two or three of them aren't obscuring what's true, what arises in response to situation is equanimity, calmness, like that guy with the heat. Or compassion in response to pain, your own or another's. Or friendliness when we run across someone else. Or wisdom, balance, constant. These things arise normally when the awareness is in sync with how things really are. But the habits that our mind has cultivated of moving with wanting, you know, in terms of the pleasant, aversion in terms of the unpleasant, and self-identification of stuff are so strong and so immediate. You know how strong habits are. So, and again, none of this is to believe, because that doesn't help. But take it in, believe it or not, doesn't matter, and use it as exploring in our experience this, with this quality of interest, not of judging, to see How does it work? How is it when there's wanting in the mind, when there's aversion in the mind? So give just little examples. So I'm describing how it is for me, and I know not just for me, but you just take it on advisement and explore for yourself if you're not familiar. But for all of them, so when there's wanting in the mind, it really narrows our experience. And what had been just wide open or simple, it's just walking, it's just like this, becomes kind of a narrow, constricted, leaning forward, off balance. And it's like what you want is looks like the most beautiful thing in the world, and everything else is kind of in the way. I use this example at the retreat just last week from years ago when I was, I used to teach in the desert in Southern California, in Yucca Valley. Probably a lot, some of you have been there. And it's lovely. I loved walking out in that desert in the early morning, and the Joshua trees, and, you know, the various birds, what are the roadrunner birds and the little lizards, and, you know, just the smell and all. And so one morning I was walking there and just appreciating, but quite present, it's just this, and suddenly the thought popped in, maybe I'll see a land tortoise, which are like the only big animals there. You don't see them much, and it's kind of a coup. Whenever someone would see one, they'd come back and tell all the rest of the staff, oh, I saw a tortoise, and this is where its hole is. So it popped in my mind, maybe I'll see a land tortoise. That could have been a thought that came and went, but clinging came up. That was a pleasant, maybe I'll see a land tortoise. And then the rest of the walk became, which I noticed later, not at the time, the whole field of attention narrowed. And instead of just being present, as I was leaning forward, walking, looking for a land tortoise, looking. And I realized later, everything, not tortoise, where's the tortoise? It completely changes the experience. You don't see one. It wasn't like the end of the world, but it's a subtle disappointment. And you come dragging, oh, I didn't see a tortoise. Yeah. When before it had just been what it was, just this natural peace and ease of mind and body when it's just present. So notice. But we're so used to craving as if that's what's going to make us happy. It kind of takes us by the nose and leads us, you know. And if we're not steady with the awareness, it's not that awareness can't be aware of craving. That's why I'm saying it. Fine. Be aware of craving. Notice how it behaves, like the example I just gave. Without that, what we tend to do is, oh, craving, we either stop being aware of the craving, because craving's unpleasant. Check it out and see. But we focus on the thing we want, and we never see the whole process. So bring awareness along when craving comes up. My brother used to have a hound dog that was trained, you know, for hunting. So, I mean, he was living in Atlanta in the suburbs, but his nose was so highly developed that he just really was led by the nose. You know, he'd come into the house, and every new smell, he just couldn't just come in and lie down. He had to go follow his nose to every new smell. And when he let him outside, he couldn't just go out in the backyard. He had to go along the edge of the fence and smell every smell there had been an animal or something. And really, I felt like that's how craving works. Just enthrall, you know, to the go for this. So bringing in awareness, start to see how that works. Similarly with the resistance, with the pulling away, with the aversion, it's so deeply trained in us. Something unpleasant, get the heck out of here, right? A lot of people are like, well, of course, get the heck out of here. You know, if I have a choice, what am I, stupid? I'm going to get the heck out of here. And as I was saying in our little group, if that always worked, believe me, none of us would be here, right? And so we're not trying to cause more unpleasantness, but to see that the strategy of avoiding everything unpleasant and doesn't work. And if we don't know the sense of just being at ease with the unpleasant, like that guy with the heat, okay, it's like this now. And the heart and mind's at peace. That's really how to be with unpleasant. We have to really cultivate and trust awareness enough to see and be steady enough to really see, is that true? Is that true? Is the suffering this unpleasant experience, or is it this reaction of mine that, oh, get away, get away, get away? I think Pema Chodron says, you know, when we're in the grip of this sense of resisting aversion, resisting unpleasant, it's like we walk around all our life tensed up like we're in the dentist's chair. Yeah, I can really, no, there's something, you know? And so we're in this, oh. And the Buddha said, and I love this, he said, the unawakened person, when in the face of an unpleasant experience, a physical unpleasant experience, mental doesn't matter, the only escape an unawakened person knows from unpleasant experience is to crave after sense pleasure. And so as soon as there's an unpleasant thing, we don't even recognize, we go for something pleasant. Again, if that always worked, we wouldn't be here doing this. But notice it without a judgment. Just notice how you're in the walking and suddenly you think, I could just go, someone brought, I could just go have a cup of tea. And we don't notice. You come, well, what's happening now? Oh, yeah, my back's a little sore. I'm a little bit bored. It's a little unpleasant. Cup of tea, that's a pleasant thought. Nothing bad with that. But just let awareness get steady and watch the process. See what's really going on. And something really mild like that, you can keep on walking. Oh, yeah, I want a cup of tea, want a cup of tea, want, and then that just goes away. It's just the next, there's just a step. There's just hearing, just, you know, the peace and ease of this moment. A moment, maybe you don't notice that, but as the awareness gets more steady, we start to notice that. Maybe the back's still a little sore, but it's just the peace and ease of this moment. And then in the next moment, something else comes. Oh, no, I don't want a cup of tea, but I could go lie down. That would be good. And then the whole thing starts again, you know? And so it's not like we're going to come to an end point. We're not going to come to an end. There is one end point, but that's not where we're hopefully going to come to today. And because our mind, bodies are rising anew in each moment. So, okay, I conquered craving. Peace and ease of walking. Now it's all going to be fine. And 2 minutes later, this is where trusting awareness again and again, we really start to see. And the third, which is really in some ways the most deeply ingrained and can't understand so well just intellectually, but the third confusion, delusion, is really the sense of personality view, of taking any experience of mind or body to be me or mine. Or to put it more simply, just thinking it's all about me. Do you ever notice that? Like when I mentioned the group photo today and I said we'd all immediately go to our own self and everyone laughed, because we would. Or an example I often use that Joseph Goldstein uses, it's about him, but he uses it, so it's okay. Where he was on a retreat himself in the food line, you know, like waiting for the meal, like you do a retreat with maybe 50, 60 people behind him. And he was the second in line. So the first person in line ahead of him took off, you know, the big lid off the big pot and took it off and dropped it onto the floor, made a heck of a racket, right? And everyone's just standing there, you know, watching their mind, hopefully, or judging or whatever. So everyone looks and sees, oh, who did this? And Joseph said, he just wanted to stand up and say, it wasn't me. First thing that comes in the mind, right? It's all about me. So just noticing that, not making it right or wrong, but noticing this habit in our mind, because this really narrows the bandwidth of our experience. It all becomes me and other, all about me, what makes me feel fulfilled or whatever. So this is from the Dalai Lama on excessive self-focus. So I would just say that's this all about me thing. So the paradox is that although the drive behind this excessive really focusing on ourself is to seek greater happiness, it ends up doing exactly the opposite. When you focus so much on yourself, you become disconnected and alienated from others. In the end, you also become alienated from yourself. Since the need for connection with others is such a fundamental part of who we are as human beings. But I would say not even the need for connection, I'd say the fact that actually we're not separate and we all affect and are affected by each other. That's just how it is. But when it's all about me, it's a sense of, you know, protection, and you're out there, and what's okay and what isn't. Dalai Lama again. With too much self-focus, your vision becomes narrow. And with this, even a small problem appears out of proportion and unbearable. Have you noticed that? Just a little thing. When I'm the focus, it blows up huge. I give it, this is a simple example from many, many years ago. I was traveling by myself in India, and I had booked an overnight train trip somewhere. But I was young, and I didn't really know all how to do so. You can book ladies' cars, but I didn't know that. So I had, a berth in a four berth car. It's just like a little, you know, you sit in the day, and then the night they just put down the platform and you just lie on it. So I was lying there, and then I realized it was me and three men were in this car. So I didn't feel comfortable. Nobody was doing anything. I didn't feel comfortable. And I was lying there, and these three guys were lying there, and I just was getting like more and more uncomfortable and thinking, oh, these guys are really in my car. They were doing nothing. I mean, they were staring at me, but that's actually isn't even rude in India. That's just normal. But I was feeling, you know, really stared at and getting more and more quietly. I mean, it just looked like I was lying there, but quietly, really uncomfortable and annoyed and angry, and these guys intruding on my space and my car and bothering me. And it was really unpleasant. Now, mind you, externally, nothing was going on. And at some point, because this is like all night, you know, I'm lying there like this, okay, and my car, and it's whipping up. It's all about me in the car. And I don't know where this wisdom came from, but suddenly the mind just thought, oh, this is our car. Oh, right, this is our car. And it just kind of calmed down. I didn't say anything. I hadn't said anything before. And I didn't like jump up and go, hi, guys, this is our car. I didn't do anything. I was just still lying there. But then when the morning comes, you have to get up, you know, and they put the seats up and everyone sits down. And all of a sudden, these three guys' families emerge. There's all of a sudden there was 20 of us in this car, the kids and the wives and the cousins, I don't know who all, but very different. And then they were very, you know, it was like really friendly at every stop. They, oh, here, try these jalebis. We'll buy this for you. Try these. We'll try this for you. How do you like our country? And it's like all, it really was like our car. And the only thing that changed was that aversion, that self-centeredness, you know, in my mind, that it was all about me. And you think, oh, it's like this now. Basically, it could have said just, it's like this now. Instead of it's our car, it's like this now. And stop resisting it and be present. If there had been, which there wasn't, something aggressive or something threatening, well, it's like this now would have been able to recognize it and take appropriate action. It's not like stupid. It's like, so you know what I mean? It's not like, okay, whatever. I can see clearly. But there wasn't. There was only just ease and friendliness. And so just starting to see the difference, that this is what, as the Buddha said, these habits of mind, and that's all they are, habits of reactivity to the pleasant, to the unpleasant, to any experience that we somehow in that moment is picked out as being me or mine. And the Buddha said, this is what gets in the way of recognizing freedom. So in terms of nibbana, the sense of liberation of heart and mind, the unconditioned, or the mind and heart free, liberated through non-clinging. It says, it's visible here and now. To what extent? To the extent that greed, to the extent that hatred, to the extent that confusion is not present in the consciousness, in the heart stream. And so, even just a moment, just moments when we're awake, there's awareness and there's not greed, hatred, confusion. It's not like, oh, we're blasted into some great space, but notice those moments of just, as I said, simplicity of ease. The mind isn't going, peace and ease, neon sign. It's not doing that. And often we don't notice because it's a little more neutral. And we're mostly tuned in to notice, you know, what really makes an impact, which a great deal of the time is aversion and greed making the impact, or really fantastic, wonderful experience. But peace and ease is often quite lovely, but it's calm, it's neutral. You're just taking a step. You're just sitting here, and there's a moment where there's not greed, hatred, confusion. It's just this. Recognizing those. Don't make it a big deal, but as awareness gets more steady, we not only recognize when these obscurations are present, we keep noticing and see how they act to bring us into more and more confusion. You get a sense of that, like on that train. The more and more I was going with it, I'm right and they're wrong and they shouldn't be here, nah, 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 the more and more and more I was suffering. Completely extraneous suffering. And in the sense of the recognition of the reality shifting, oh, it's like this now, all that went away. Peace and ease. It doesn't mean the experience could still be quite active, or that guy's sweating, you know, sweating to death there in Burma, but not to death. It's still like that. But there's a peace and ease. As Myingyur Rinpoche says, we start to recognize a peace that comes from the stability of awareness that's not dependent on the presence or absence of pleasant or unpleasant. When we're locked in the habits of craving and aversion, is that the only response we know? Then really, unknowns to ourselves, and it's what we're taught, you know, that's what the whole world teaches us, kind of we're basing our sense of happiness or even just okayness on at least the absence of really bad, unpleasant stuff, and needing pleasant experience for happiness, for ease, for fulfillment. And often we may be privileged enough that we have access to a fair amount of pleasant. A lot of us in this world are a lot more privileged than others. But no matter how privileged one is, there's going to be a lot of time in everyone's life when it isn't, when the difficult, sad, traumatic things happen, you know. How can we find the ability to rest in this with peace and ease, but with awareness, not with delusion of pretending it's not happening, head in the sand thing. And so one of the things I love about a retreat, when I said these moments of practicing awareness and the fact that it isn't just all nicey nice, is essential. Because this is really where we're learning how the habits of confusion and suffering arise and get fed when the awareness doesn't recognize them. How in some moments of steady awareness, suddenly it's like, oh, right, that's what's happening. The triangle goes in the triangle. Oh, that's the problem. And it all goes away. Noticing that in little things, because it's the same way the heart and mind works in more complicated things in our life. It's from Tejaniya again. Because we want to learn about the nature of the mind and objects, really how the mind works, how suffering is created, how it dissipates. Because of that, we're not trying to calm the mind down or to remove objects in this style. We don't interfere or control, but observe, because we want to understand the mind and the objects that arise in their natural state. We want to really see how they're working. This is one aspect of right view. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? So that's in understanding why. I mean, it's certainly valid in other forms to calm the mind down first. I'm not saying that. But in terms of this, that's why we're not trying. Because until there's understanding, any trying we do to have certain objects, get rid of other objects, if it's so subtle, this tendency to go towards pleasant and avoid unpleasant, that we'll think we're just trying to calm down and get it right. But subtly, we'll be trying to remove the objects that we don't like and have the objects that we like. And that just gets more and more subtle. So this sense of just letting reality arise in its own moment after moment after moment in a relatively safe environment. I'm not saying, you know, walk down the middle of the freeway and just like, oh, notice what happens. What happens if a car hits me? It hurts the button. No, in a relatively safe environment to really notice how the mind works. So in a more, like on a retreat level, when I was talking today about just letting awareness just be with painful, unpleasant experience, not damaging yourself. Because you also bring in wisdom. Like somebody said, you know, some people sit feeling, I've had friends who did this, feeling pain in their knee, think, well, I'm not going to move. I'm just going to be with it. I can be with the pain, be with the pain over days, over weeks, and they completely blow their knee out. This is not awareness. This is not wisdom. I would call it willpower, you know, or some ideal of what it should look like. But there's not wisdom, which is like, what's really happening here? So there's times in anything when you be with pain, you can see, you can feel the mind somewhat balanced. Awareness is there, but the pain itself, not the aversion to it, that's different. But the pain itself is increasing in a retreat. Every time you get up from the sitting, the pain is worse. As the day goes on, it keeps getting worse. Not the mind more reactive, that's different. The pain getting worse. That's like, okay, this is what's really happening. Sit in a chair for the love of God instead of sitting cross-legged and blowing your knee out. It's just intelligence. So we're not saying hurt yourself. But as we all know, there's plenty of just using pain in sitting. Simple pain. I've had retreats where my shoulders for 3 months felt like boiling hot iron spikes were being driven into them through the sitting. It was mildly unpleasant. I'd get up from the sitting and it would be gone. Oh, I go, really? Okay. It's really gone. And I sit and it's happening again. And well, why is this happening? What does it mean? Some big, you know, some big opening. That's just the mind, you know, trying to move away from it. I never got a reason for it. You think, but anyway, it was clear that I wasn't damaging my body because it would completely go away. So that's an extreme example. But so say you're having a sensation, it's unpleasant, and our conditioned reaction, which may say, of course, it hurts, move. Why should I sit here and hurt when I can move? And we think, yeah, right, you know, that's normal. There's aversion to the pain. That's how it should be. You shouldn't have pain, you should move. I move, I feel better. That's how it is. And it's unquestioned that it's unpleasant. That unpleasant sensation is causing my suffering. If I get rid of that unpleasant sensation, the suffering ends. Now, doesn't that make sense? Isn't that what we've been taught? You think, what are these people are crazy telling me to sit here and see? So if we always go with that, the sense is that, yeah, the unpleasant caused my suffering. I get rid of it, I'm okay. Nothing is learned. Nothing is learned. What's been fed in that moment is the same habit, right? Run away from the unpleasant. That's the only way we know to get rid of suffering. So in this sense of cultivating steady awareness, and that's why we're saying steady, this relaxed awareness that allows us to just keep remembering no matter what's happening, so that we're not ultimately picking and choosing which experiences are worth bringing awareness to and which ones not. Because then we don't see the whole show because we'll pick and choose again by our habits. But just watching whatever's going on. So it's unpleasant. And as some of you start to recognize, oh, here's really resistance in the mind. That's arising. It's not the same as the physical sensation. They may seem so married that they go together. It's normal. Yeah, it's normal. But that doesn't mean it has to be. But we'll only learn that for ourselves through the steady awareness, and wisdom starts to see there really are times, like that guy with the heat, all of a sudden, oh, the body's hot and the mind is cool. It's cool. It's often talked about the coolness of the heart-mind that's free from kilesa at a particular moment. It's not burning with aversion or greed or me, me, me. It's like, ah, steady awareness. But even if then you go ahead and act from aversion, steady awareness. Keep noticing the effect. Keep noticing the effect. Because every time we're acting from aversion and not recognizing it, really what's being fed in that moment is aversion. So in the next moment, aversion's a little easier to come out. You know, that's a little better. But it's not really enough better. Maybe if I go like that, it'll be more better. That's okay. But no, it's not really. And it just, you know, you turn into one big fidget, as James likes to say. But so the steady awareness, we don't know what we don't know, right? And if we think we know what we're looking for, we're already looking for something we've made up. that we think we know. There's no space for the reality that we're not aware of to reveal itself. So this quality of the simplicity of steady moment receptive awareness has amazing power to start to let reality reveal itself in all kinds of ways. So I was using simple physical sensation, but it's also about emotion, it's about thoughts, you know, we'll talk more about thoughts tomorrow. And just recognizing, I talked about greed and aversion, but recognizing with interest when it occurs, a sense of taking any experience personally, which is often happening, but it's not always happening. So what I mean by that is really, as I was saying before, the way the Buddha describes our moment-to-moment experience, and again, don't believe me, look and see, because you know our mind's creating all these thoughts, but there's these, we're seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or physical sensation, touching, or there's a mental realm, thoughts, emotions, moods. These things are occurring. And like with seeing, like I said before, seeing encompasses the sense of the eye door, the sense of the object seen, and consciousness. That's all coming together in the action of seeing. So these things are happening as you're going through the day here, sitting, walking, one after the other, right? All kinds of experiencing, thinking, hearing, seeing, thinking, feeling, hearing, tasting, just going around. And many of them, they're just coming and going. Not everyone is grasped. They're just coming and going, peaceful or not. But suddenly, out of that ongoing field of experience, one of them is suddenly privileged as a sense of being me or mine. That's sensation. Maybe you have even sensation. There's lots of little sensations just coming and going. Each one you're not going, my tingle, my buzz, my vibration, my coolness. Oh, my knee pain. That one is mine. You get a sense of the difference? So right then, there's this sense of the contraction of either aversion clinging around that particular experience, and it kind of gets pulled out of the others. We're making it personal. Just noticing that. Don't make it right or wrong, but noticing that. It gets, to me, fascinating. So like when Joseph was standing in the line and there was all that noise, and there was a sense right to them, that sense of that noise and thinking, what do people think of me? That thought became personal. You know, he really wanted to stand up and say, don't think badly of me. The same thought could go through your walking and goes, oh, I hope people don't think badly of me, and it's just gone. And then it comes back, oh, no, what are they thinking? Do they think I don't know how to walk? I'm not, you know, me. So just noticing the contraction on anything that's me, and then where it goes from that. So just a sound, you know, we're just hearing, Oh, bird call. Yeah, it's so nice. So the nice, the pleasant, that's me. That reminds me of when I was in the Girl Scouts and we went camping at this place and they had all these birds and it was so lovely. And oh, my mother used to lead us. And I remember that night that it rained and we all got flooded out and your whole history comes up from hearing. And then you go, oh, here I am. That personal, that's gone. It's gone. That was a thought happening. It's gone. Peace and ease. And then another thought. Oh, gosh, all that time and I didn't even notice I was thinking. Hopeless. And then that one's, you know, that's me. A hopeless. Why am I even bothering with this? This is stupid. I am useless. Whatever it is goes into the whole thing. Me. But awareness can just be noticing how when something is, you know, privileged out as me or mine, it leads into the whole story and wanting and disliking and moods and a whole world. And then that whole world of you vanishes. Like the whole world of me hating the guys on the train, it vanishes. It's not like you overcame it. It stops being created in that moment. And there's just a sense of a step or a sense of a hearing or whatever's happening next. Can we be that in a moment, just that simple? Just that simple to land in now, not hating or anything about this sense of me being created in us, but watching that process. And over time, we start to recognize how it is going to keep happening. But we can just recognize it. I find it often, not always, quite amusing. Not always. But just seeing how it comes and goes, instead of, you know, all these different me's coming and going. And the simplicity, when it's not there, really starts to open up in our hearts and minds an understanding beyond that of thought of the potential of ease, of peace, with just what is right now. It doesn't have to be anything special. So this is our practice, the work of the meditation, but that's our whole life, of the mind that's knowing. The sixth sense experiences come and go. Each moment's arising from natural causes and conditions. When those conditions change, that particular object experience changes, dissolves, the next one arises. And it's just this simplicity and honesty of, it's like this now. It's like this now. Like someone said, in the fresh instant of the present moment, free from concepts, just, it's like this now. You don't even need to put words. So just end with sharing a little experience of a dear friend of mine. The simplicity, the freedom of this total simplicity in the present moment. A dear friend, she's in her early 90s and is in hospice. But when I visited her last fall, she was in her assisted living. And this is a person, so getting more and more weak and with heart problems, but her mind really quite clear. And she's been a very profound practitioner, meditator for at least the last 40 years. Very sincere. She's done, 10 or 12 3-month retreats at least, and many other. Very wise, very humble person. So I was just, visiting her. And so her life, of course, she didn't really start practice, I think, till her 40s or so. And she'd had a very rich, full life, family life, married life, really living society in higher educational institutions, very wide-ranging life. And now her life is so restricted, as happens in an assisted living facility and like two little rooms and, eats there and can't really walk very far without help, but could walk around. But she was saying, and recently she was in hospice and she said the same thing to friends. She said, with so much sincerity, because she's very simple and direct. She said, this is the most interesting time of my life. I said, really? How so? She said, well, we were sitting here, and then just a little bit, like from here to the pole, is the kitchen. She said, well, when I'm walking over to make a cup of tea, that's totally life. I'm walking over there, and that's everything. Total presence. It's so just complete. And then when I'm pouring the tea water, that's everything. That's what there is. It's so interesting. It's so fascinating. It's just total presence with that. And she said it even more simply. I can't even replicate how simple and honest she is. And so it's this complete presence and wakefulness in that moment. And you can see that sense of awakeness, of real presence, of peace and ease, is not dependent on the situation or the activity. Walking across the floor, pouring tea water, the most interesting moment of her life, because it's this moment. And that's all there ever is, this moment. And so this is really, we don't have to understand it all intellectually, but the more we start to have a little bit trust in awareness, it brings us into this moment, in the moment that we're totality, not split out or funneled away with wanting it different or trying to get such, it's like this. More and more, that trust in the wholeness, the purity of heart-mind that isn't wanting things different, that starts to grow. More trust in that, less trust in wanting aversion and protecting me as ways to peace and ease. So I end with that. Thank you for your attention. Oops. So let's just sit for a moment quietly. Or actually, there's not much time left, so why don't you just stand up for a moment and, you know, just ease your body, and then we'll just sit for the last 15 minutes. Sit with peace and ease or with greed and aversion, whatever's happening.